Welcome to the Scene Gene Podcast. I'm Matthew Jaber Stifler, Research and Content Manager at the Arab American National Museum. The Scene Gene Podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies and the Arab American National Museum. Joining us today is Zaina Arafat. Zaina Arafat is an LGBTQ Arab Muslim American fiction and nonfiction writer. Her stories and essays have appeared in publications including The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, Christian Science Monitor, BuzzFeed, Vice, Guernica, Literary Hub, and NPR. In recognition of her work, she was awarded the Arab Women Migrants from the Middle East Fellowship at Jack Jones Literary Arts. She holds an MA in International Affairs from Columbia University and an MFA from Iowa. Her debut motto, "You Exist Too Much," was selected as a most anticipated book for 2020 by O, the Oprah magazine, Good Morning America, Vogue, Elle, and Harper's Bazaar. She lives in Brooklyn and is currently at work on a collection of essays. Zaina, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, I am always interested in meeting new Arab American writers. It seems every year there are more and more, which is a wonderful thing. You're going to be reading a selection from your novel, You Exist Too Much, which was published in 2020. If you can tell us a little bit about the book and a little bit about the passage that you're going to read.
Absolutely. So the novel is a story of a LGBTQ Palestinian American woman who is tracing a pattern of oftentimes destructive relationships against the backdrop of her own Arab and Muslim culture, all while sort of coming to terms with her relationship to her mother, who is an immigrant. And so the book explores the tensions between the immigrant generation and the first generation. It explores sexuality, especially in the context of Arab Muslim culture. And it also asks questions along the lines of how much do our collective cultural histories impact who we are as people today? So yeah, how much does the past bear on the present, both our personal pasts and our collective histories? And the passage I'm going to read is the opening. I'm going to start with the opening pages of the novel, which is a scene that's set in Bethlehem. And you don't really need much more context since these are the very first few pages. So I'll go ahead and start reading. In Bethlehem, when I was 12, men in airy white gowns sat at a three-legged table outside the Church of the Nativity. They ran prayer beads through their fingers and sipped mint tea in gold-rimmed cups shaped like hourglasses, steam floating off the surface and up into the bright blue sky. I walked past them with my mother and my uncle as we wandered through the holy city. One of the men called out, "Haram, forbidden. For the especially devout among us, it's haram to eat meat unless the animal has been killed in a specific way. Haram to drink alcohol, haram for a pubescent girl to expose her legs in a biblical city." It occurred to me then that I wasn't a flat-chested kid anymore, that curves had begun to appear along the length of me. I was no longer indistinguishable from a boy child. "What should we do?" I asked my mother. I felt a pulsing lump take shape in my throat as I noticed her teeth gritting, her jaw extended, and temples shimmering. My great-grandparents' house was where we were staying and where all of my clothes were, 36 miles and 3 checkpoints away. I felt myself go cold as I closed my eyes and prepared to receive her reaction. I knew better than to try and preempt it with an apology. All I could do was strategically try to calm myself, to remember that the anticipation was heavier than the thing itself. I should have had more sense than to dress in such a way when we were visiting the birthplace of a prophet, albeit not our own. My mother had, and still has, a native's knowledge. She knows the rules instinctively in that part of the world, and I only ever learn them by accident. "Basita," said my uncle, "it's okay." My mother looked me up and down. We approached the main door of the church, and the men hissed again. My uncle ran the tips of his fingers across his mustache, then looked to my mother and me. "Come," he said, "I have an idea." We followed him into a gift shop just off Manger Square. He dropped a few coins on the counter, then asked the shopkeeper if we could use his bathroom. My mother grabbed a Kit Kat off the shelf and tore it open, breaking apart two sticks without a second thought. My uncle dropped three more coins on the counter. The man pointed towards the back. My uncle thanked him and led the way. His master plan was that he would trade me his trousers for my Roxy surfer shorts. He went into the bathroom first, and I could hear sounds of fumbling, his belt jangling as it hit the floor. He opened the door slightly and handed his pants to my mother so she could administer the swap. She then stood in front of me while I took off my shorts. "Hurry," she said, her most frequently used word. I pulled on the pair of pants. They sagged on me. I had to tighten the belt all the way up to the last hole and then roll the waist so that they wouldn't fall off, leaving me even more exposed than I had been before. I stepped out of the bathroom and looked at my uncle. I examined my new curves against his ridiculous pasty legs, gangly and covered in sporadic patches of hair, my shorts tight against his thighs. It occurred to me in that moment to question why, as a man, his bare legs were somehow less troubling than mine. It was a double standard, a shame I had simply accepted until then. In acquiring my gender, I had become offensive. But as I stood in front of him, an unexpected pride began to swell inside me. I liked the way his trousers made me feel, like I could get attention from boys, from girls. Inti weled wala binet? Are you a boy or a girl? A security guard at the Intercontinental Hotel in Amman had once asked my cousin Noor this question when deciding whether to lead her into the curtain-shrouded women's check for an intimate pat-down before she could enter the lobby. "Binet," Noor had responded. "Girl?" She'd been insulted by the question, the uncertainty it revealed. But not me, not that day. Wearing my uncle's baggy trousers, I enjoyed occupying blurred lines. Ambiguity was an unsettling yet exhilarating space. As we walked back towards the Church of the Nativity, I looked at my mother and smiled, desperate for her to smile back. But she withheld. She offered only a freshly disconcerting look, scrunching up her forehead so that lines appeared, her cheekbones protruding, her mouth forming a terrifying expression of indifference. At the time, I couldn't quite place the source of it. Had she noticed my contentment? Did it scare her? Only now, years later, do I think I understand. It was in that moment that she first realized I wasn't like her. The trousers were a demarcation line, one that separated me from my mother and her lineage. I wonder sometimes if that day was the start of something, whether it's when I began this habit of constant seeking, of endlessly striving to earn my way back, a pattern that would send me on a misguided and self-destructive quest for love. I communicated something to my mother as I stood there smiling in a pair of men's pants, a message I didn't know I was sending her. She has always known first what I have yet to discover, has always seen it before I could. "Look at me," I wanted to say to her then. "Please don't look away."
Thank you. It's such a fitting opening vignette. We learn so much about the character and what's to come, especially the relationship with the mother. It's just, and it's very gripping. I think it's a beautiful way to open a book that was hard to put down. I wanted to keep finding out what, not like in the train wreck fascination, but I was like, I got to find out what happens next, because this character is clearly on a trajectory here, and I kind of want to see where it ends.
Yeah, I mean, I chose that opening, that scene as the opening, because of the fact that I felt that it encapsulated so many of the themes that are present in the book, like the sort of cross-culturalism and the pain and alienation and humor that can accompany that experience, as well as the sort of sexual and gender identity that's forming in this character and that's sort of motivating and something that's motivating her behavior and also something that she's grappling with throughout the novel. And it also, to me, kind of paints a picture of the relationship between the mother and the daughter, which is indeed one of the central threads of the book. So I'm glad that you like the opening.
Yeah. And then, I mean, it sets up the relationship with Palestine too. Like, it constantly reminds the reader that this character is in between multiple worlds all the time, physical and emotional, and starting in Palestine, I think was good, because we get back to Palestine a few more times, or Jordan specifically also. And yeah, it really helped set that up.
Right, exactly. Right. That sort of having a foot in both of those worlds, you know, the sort of world of Palestine, world of Jordan, Lebanon as well, which features later, but and also the US and the sort of like, what does that actually look like? I mean, it's one of those cliches that you hear all the time. And you also hear of it as being a good thing, but you know, there's it's a pretty, it can be a loaded experience, or at least a more like charged one. So yeah.
And I mean, just me personally, I'm one of these like follow the rules kinds of person. So I kind of like got panicked when the character realized they were wearing inappropriate clothing, because I was like, oh my gosh, I would never want to be in that situation where I feel unprepared and sticking out. And then we see throughout the book that, you know, the narrator is always worried, you know, looking over her shoulder when she's going to hold somebody's hand or kiss somebody, you know, always wondering, am I being culturally appropriate in this moment, or being watched for some reason?
Completely. Like navigating the lines of what is appropriate, what is acceptable culturally, and, you know, even just culturally, socially, in a religious context, on a personal level, all of that is part of this narrator's like struggle indeed. And just like feeling as if she inhabits in many ways like unacceptable spaces, or else behaves in ways that are, you know, disapproved of, and just something as minor as wearing shorts as opposed to long pants can have like huge implications or repercussions for her.
And speaking of the narrator, I was 2/3 of the way through the book, and then I watched an interview you had done, one of the many interviews I found with you online, and they were talking about how the narrator doesn't have a name. And I had to stop, and I'm like, no, of course she has a name. And I'm like trying to remember, and I'm like, oh wait, no, the narrator does not have a name. I'm like 200 pages into this, and I didn't even realize that. So that was really fascinating for me.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, that was a very conscious decision. And the title of the book is, you know, You Exist Too Much. And essentially when you tell someone you exist too much, and it's a line, the title comes from a line that's the mother character speaks to the narrator. And, you know, when you tell someone that, you're essentially saying you should exist less. And so her not having a name, a lot of is a sort of homage to that, you know, existing less, taking up less space in the world. And I think a part of what her journey is from, you know, the beginning to the end is going from a place where she feels like she can't exist in her own right by virtue of, you know, just who she is, LGBTQ, sort of in between cultures, not really belonging to one or the other, all of those places that she's still coming to terms with. So from going to that, from that place to a place of feeling like she can exist in her own right, and that, you know, her existence is valid as it is, and that she need not try and be smaller or take up less space. So yeah, the no name is was tricky to write, but in the end it served a larger purpose. Also, she defines herself constantly in relation to others, like she's Layla's daughter or so-and-so's lover or what have you. And so that's another reason why she doesn't have a name.
No, that's a really nice convention. And you didn't set out immediately to write it without a name. That sort of came a little bit later.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, I started to really inhabit her mindset in such a way that anytime I wrote, you know, the name that I had given her, I felt like, oh, she would feel totally uncomfortable taking up this much space, like on the pages of a novel. And so I started to like try writing without the use of her name, and it just felt better. And it was a very tricky kind of dance to go through and figure out how to write a book without having a name for the protagonist. Trying to make that clear and make was tricky, but yeah, in the end, that's what happened.
The book's been out for just about a year now, right? And you've done a ton of interviews, and you've gotten a lot of a positive reception for it. Have you felt any sort of, like, do you feel like you get different receptions based on whether the audience or the venue is Arab or Arab American or not? And do you think, like, you're hearing different things from maybe a mostly Arab American audience?
Yes and no. I mean, like, One of the things that I like about the reception is that Arabs and Arab Americans and non-Arabs and non-Arab Americans have all, in some ways, they've like tapped into the larger sort of themes that are being explored that go beyond, like that are like almost like post-cultural in some way, where it's like, oh, there's a theme about unattainability, or there's mm-hmm. the theme of sort of like, you know, well, love addiction is also a theme that runs through here, but, and been able to just sort of also like access the human story, regardless of the fact that the character is Palestinian and regardless of the fact that much of the books is set in the Middle East, you know. But I also like the fact that readers have really appreciated that as well, that like a lot of Arab and Arab Americans have sort of reached out to me and said like how refreshing it was, or how rare they felt it was to see an Arab woman sort of with such agency on the pages of a novel, or just even to see one reflected in literature at all, like in a sort of contemporary context, to see a queer Arab mm-hmm. character was really heartening for some people. And, you know, just hearing the different ways that readers identified with this narrator and ways that they access the story and the place, right? And the way that they responded to the presence of the Middle East throughout the book was really, really just inspiring for me. And often, I guess, Arab and Arab American readers wanted to talk more about the sort of like background of her sort of political background and cultural history as a Palestinian, and how much of that is at play here, how much of that affects this narrator and her and the mother as well, who's like a large presence in the book. And I often kind of talk about, I mean, people use the term intergenerational trauma, but I talk about the sort of like trickle down trauma of like how trauma that's affecting the generation before, like the mother's generation, how does that affect the narrator really? Well, I guess it affects her insofar as she's raised by somebody that's carrying all this trauma, and that, you know, has also been, is an immigrant, right? For reasons that have to do with a lot of Palestine's history, of course. How does all of that trickle into this narrator's life and impact who she is and, you know, shape her own traumas? Every time I would hear the term intergenerational trauma, I really wanted to understand, like, what does that really speak to? Like, what does that mean exactly? Especially if, like, well, there's a generation, like the first generation, that isn't directly experiencing those traumas.
And you definitely, you get to a point very, very much toward the end of the novel where the protagonist, like, forgives the mother and feels bad for the mother for carrying the trauma and the hurt that the mother carried. And that was unexpected as the reader, I think, to come across that, to be like, oh, now there's a whole nother level here to this relationship. And so that was really a really nice turn for me as the reader to see.
Oh, well, I'm glad you thought that way. I mean, I think there are many sort of trajectories of the book, and one of them is the relationship between the mother and the daughter, and the narrator going from a place of hurt and anger at the hands of the mother to arriving at a place of like compassion and love. And a lot of that involved giving the mother space in the book to exist in her own right. So there's like a chapter in the book that is just sort of the mother's backstory and sort of from the mother's kind of perspective, and to just sort of, you know, because we spend all this time experiencing the behaviors of other people, and, you know, oftentimes those behaviors can be hurtful to us without always knowing what is behind those, you know, what's going on inside this person that's acting in this way. You know, often there's like a whole just world of history and trauma and what have you that doesn't necessarily excuse it. It just helps one to form compassion and helps to understand it and maybe feel less pain on the receiving end of it.
It's fascinating because, you know, I mentioned to you before the podcast began that, you know, I interviewed Renda Girard about Love is an Ex-Country, and it's very similar in her book. You know, I told her in that interview, I said, you know, when you got towards the end and you sort of had this moment of forgiveness for your father, I said, I, as the reader, was not there with you. I was not ready to be there and forgive the father figure. But then she said, you know, how much that actually helped her in real life, that moment of forgiveness. And so I see a parallel of like getting to that point eventually and the good it can do for the character and not just for the reader to have that moment of release.
Absolutely. I think that's a really great point. And I know I'm a huge fan of Renda's work. And part of our job as writers is to take people that are either villainous or villainized in some way, or just like, you know, can be portrayed in a negative light, and to find some positive, is to humanize them, to fully like multidimensionalize them, to really, you know, allow the reader to find a place of, find an entry point of compassion. Because, you know, that's every human being, I think, especially parents, I suppose, there is something that they are carrying or that they have experienced that has like sort of, I think, led to their mindset, which can be on the surface very frustrating and hard to accept. And that's sort of the job of the writers, to like find that entry point into compassion without excusing bad behavior.
Yeah, I have two young children, and I think about that all the time. Like, where, how are my issues and quirks and things going to manifest in them later? And what are they going to think about it and say about it? It's quite fascinating.
I bet they're only going to have positive things to say.
That's right. Only positive
things. And they'll never need to be writers.
No, absolutely not. So going back to the question about reception, and you were talking about, you know, your portrayal of an Arab American character, it's very nuanced. It's not heavy-handed. You don't have to keep reminding the reader that this person is eating hummus and tabbouleh. You know, it's very much like they're just a person in the world who has this heritage and is connected to it in very certain ways. But I'm wondering if at any point editors or publishers wanted more Arabness, you know, make this character more Arab. We want more of that. Have you ever gotten any sort of pressure to do that?
Of course. That was for me a huge obstacle in the publication journey of this book, was like when I would share pages with agents at first and then editors, like they would want an orientalized, exotified, you know, book that wasn't what this was. They would say, like, we want more spices from the marketplace. We want more camels. I'm not even kidding. More women in hijabs, more, you know, repressed women. And like, truly, they would say these things. It was like, why isn't the mom wearing hijab? Or like, that would be a question I would get. And I'd be like, well, I mean, because not every Arab Muslim woman wears one. And, you know, with the spices from the marketplace, like I was like, should we staple a spice pack to the front cover of every book? Like, it was really interesting and tough for me because, you know, I wanted the book to have a life. And at the same time, when I set out to write, I mean, from the beginning, I began my career as a journalist. And my goal was to challenge the misperceptions and the sort of misrepresentations that I was seeing on, you know, CNN and in mainstream media of Arabs and Muslims. And then I arrived at fiction thinking that that might be an even more sort of interesting and subversive way to challenge those stereotypes, because you're not directly telling people, oh no, Arabs and Muslims aren't like the ones you see on TV. You're just creating characters that happen, that are engaging in, you know, very familiar, relatable actions and activities, and that happen to be Arab and Muslim. And that might be an interesting way to sort of allow Western readers to access what an actual Arab might exist in the world as. And so, yeah, so it was really hard for me to balance that kind of feedback against what I was trying to achieve. And in the end, I just sort of had to say no to all of that. And I found, I mean, there is one camel in the book, though, I will say.
I
think there are maybe a couple of spices. I think I mentioned some spices at some point. But I did find, like, the agent that I ended up going with and the editor, the agent read the story for precisely that, like a human story about a girl who is, you know, constantly falling in love with women she can't have and trying to trace the roots of that pattern. And, you know, all of the rest, you know, the Arab background, the, you know, immigrant mother, like all of that was just gave the book added richness, but it wasn't what she was reading for. And same with my editor, who happens to be British and therefore has a different relationship with the Middle East than American editors. But it was the right relationship for the purpose of this book, because he did not want all of those exotic elements emphasized.
That's great. I mean, Moja Kaf, who is also on this podcast series, you know, has written about that. And you know, she's been writing for a long time. And the world, the publishing world has changed, hopefully for the better, as you're demonstrating by the editor you ended up with. But, you know, she's written about those challenges and the only kinds of Arab women that, that publishers wanted to portray, especially in the 90s and right after 9/11. You also mentioned you, in your acknowledgments, you say that the jacket design, you know, was the perfect design. And I can only imagine, did you have, were there any of those Orientalist things thrown at you for the jacket design?
Actually, amazingly, no. Funny enough, it, like the only change to the cover that, what, so I was initially this cover, except in pastel colors and without a sort of like stripe across the body. And I said, I want bolder colors and I want like the body to be more, a little less distinguishable. And they changed it and that was it. Perfect. So I was so lucky. I mean, honestly, my publishing house, Catapult, is just incredible. They're not at, they're just the right people because they're smart readers and they're not Orientalists in any way. And so I can only imagine the other covers that, you know, had I gone with the wrong place or other Arab writers might have encountered.
Yeah, there definitely would have been a minaret in the background and a camel and a veiled woman at some point, for sure. Yeah. So let's back up. Let's talk about you. And so would you say you grew up in an Arab American community, or were you like the only Arab in your school or the only Arab in your neighborhood kind of thing?
Both, actually. I was indeed the only Arab that I knew of in my school. There was one other and they called her the, I'm not even kidding, they called her the terrorist, like her friend group. God. And I didn't have any Arab friends. And back when I was growing up in my school, back when I was growing up, it wasn't like what it is today. I mean, I'm not saying we've achieved any like perfect harmony among cultures, but I think diversity is more encouraged these days. But back then it was like just objectively bad to be different, especially like in, you know, grade school and high school. But then my parents were friends with a lot of like Syrians and Lebanese in the Washington, D.C. area, and they had kids. And I would see those kids from time to time. And that way I did get to have some sort of community. And I did have like, you know, an Arabic teacher who came to our house and I went to Arabic school on Saturdays. But in my day-to-day school life, I felt really alienated and just like, wow, this sucks. But in other ways, you know, I was lucky to have access to that community and to get to go to the Middle East all the time and, you know, feel less different in some way, but to also then feel different because I was too American and, you know, all that typical stuff. But yeah, schooling was hard.
So was writing always an outlet for you, or is that something you developed later?
Writing was always an outlet for me. I mean, I never knew I wanted to be an actual writer because I didn't know that that was an option, because when, you know, you're Palestinian and grew up in the DC area, you think you're going to be working at like, you know, as a diplomat or at the UN or something like that. And or at least maybe a journalist. But I was always writing stories and writing in notebooks. And then, you know, I studied like philosophy in college. And I didn't really start writing until 2006 when the war broke out in Lebanon with Hezbollah and Israel. And I was just really, really moved and frustrated and felt all these things and just watching the way that the war was being depicted on television. And so I wrote like an essay and sent it out and it got published in the Christian Science Monitor. And then from there, I just kept going. And also I was told like, oh, you have a unique voice, which I now understand means like you have a unique perspective from which to write about things related to the Middle East for Western audiences and vice versa. So from there, I started writing also for a Jordanian magazine while I was in the States, writing culture stuff and what have you. So, yeah.
So who were you reading at this time in the 2000s when you were discovering your own writing voice?
No idea. Who was I reading in the 2000s? I mean, I was reading so much. I remember, I mean, I'll say I wasn't necessarily reading like Arab writers at the time, you know, at all. The closest I came to reading Arab writers back then was like, I was studying whenever I would read like Rashid Khalidi, or I read Edward Said, because I did go to Columbia and studied foreign affairs there and took a bunch of MILAT classes, but I was really into philosophy. So I was reading a lot of like Kierkegaard, Stendhal, what's that guy's name? Nietzsche, Simone de Beauvoir, Sartre. I loved philosophy. Then I was reading essays as well. Like David Sedaris at the time was someone I was really big into. Eventually I evolved like into more sort of literary essayists like Maggie Nelson and Rebecca Solnit and what have you, Leslie Jameson. And then fiction wise, this is going to sound almost pretentious and it's going to sound actually quite pretentious, but like I really like Flaubert and Proust. I liked a lot of classic French literature. I guess that's just because that's what I was mostly exposed to in school. And so it wasn't until later that I got into reading Arab writers. And I went to Jordan and met Sahar Khalifa, who was like a Jordanian writer. And I got really into her work and then started reading a bunch of other Palestinian writers as well, like Reza Shahada and what have you. But took me a while to get there just because you don't really encounter that like in high school. So in the States, I mean, watching the proliferation of Arab, like an Arab American literature in the last few years has been, it's just so empowering. It's so necessary because we want to see ourselves like not only just entering that, you know, industry here, but also because telling our stories and seeing Arab characters in so many different iterations, like reflected and not in these cartoonish sort of caricatured ways. It's awesome. I'm so happy about it.
Yeah, I was going to mention you. I read an interview with Penn that you gave that said you would love to hang out with Edward Said. And I think you're channeling him with your Flaubert and all of those things.
That's hilarious. I do really love him. And I do feel like, gosh, I think if only we could have dinner. I mean, who doesn't feel that way about Edward Said? But is that I don't know if you've read the biography, but I was reading a review of the biography and I was just like, what a fascinating human being. So
when you come to the museum in Dearborn, we have some of the artifacts that he owned on the wall, and I get to go hang out with his pipe and his reading glasses every once in a while. So you can at least be in the vicinity of things that he owned. Yeah.
That's fortunate.
Yeah. It's pretty great. So just, sticking to this idea of the Arab American community, you know, now that you've been reading more and you've kind of been connected with people, how do you find ways to connect to the Arab American community, not only through literature, but just in general?
Yeah. So, I mean, I luckily live in Brooklyn, where we also have a huge Arab American community. And so many of my friends are Arab Americans and we see each other all the time, you know, like, and all these sort of artistic performances happening, I mean, across different disciplines, music, literature, visual art. I lived in Iowa for 5 years where I didn't have that world, and returning to New York and having access to that just feels like kind of being in a desert and, you know, having access to water after quite some time. And then I also, I mean, throughout the pandemic, you know, it was a lot harder to connect with anybody. And I joined several groups, like on several listservs and several sort of like groups of Arabs across the United States where we would get together. And I'd have like a book talk with different groups across the states that I would connect with or that would reach out to me. But a couple of listservs that are really great are like Ishta, which is a sort of queer Arab listserv that's really been a huge support to me. And Arab NY is another great one.
Great. Yeah. I didn't know there were listservs still happening.
There are. I know. Wow. It's kind of nuts. it's so old school, but it's a whole thing.
That's great to know. So in the novel, this character embodies what I've seen a lot of Arab American literary scholars talking about as the like cosmopolitanism of Arab literature that you see, mainly because, especially for Palestinians, there is no clear home all the time. And so these characters become citizens of the world, you know, just comfortable wherever they are, but also uncomfortable wherever they are. And so I saw that a lot in this work, the protagonist just, on every page, you're like, they're in a new place and they're just fine there. You know, there's never this sense of out of place. And so I didn't know if you want to talk a little bit about the cosmopolitanism of the novel.
I love that point. It's so true. Certainly, like when you are a Palestinian in the diaspora, you are in so many ways. I mean, so much of that trickle down trauma for me is precisely that, both like ability to be a citizen of the world and kind of adapt to any setting and be sort of comfortably nomadic and rootless, but also the sort of, I think, downside of that is feeling nomadic and rootless in a way, and like constantly searching. So the book, so much of it is about longing, and longing for something that one doesn't have, something that one is, something that's off in the distance. That's the sort of central question, which is that why are things that are off in the distance often more appealing than what's right in front of you? So for this narrator, the idea of home is so off in the distance. It's like something that she's constantly longing for because it's just always right through her fingers because of this like rootlessness and nomadicness and just diasporic quality, and the sort of difficulty of, or the impossibility in way for many, and, you know, of having a home in the homeland of Palestine. Mm-hmm. And so that is something that comes with both, like, it just, it's two sides of the coin where there's, yeah, the positiveness. It's a sort of the word cosmopolitan is so glamorous. I love it. And it's true. Like one becomes a citizen of the world. One can just sort of ship shape, adapt, but one is also longing for something more like stable and permanent and home. And the pain of that is the other side of that rootlessness.
There's a detail in the scene where the narrator is crossing the Allenby Bridge by herself to go to a funeral. And there's just this detail of like, you know, the character bought a new point and shoot camera, you know, because it was the first time the family was all going to be together, but then they might not even get there because they might not be allowed into Palestine. And so it was just this very, that detail sticks out to me, like getting all excited to go home, but you might not even be able to get there, even though you're right across the street. So that really stuck out.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's so absurd. And I know I wanted to really highlight that absurdity, especially with the camera, which is like, it's just a camera. And, you know, the way that just the little things, the questions that one gets asked that, you know, could make or break your whole visit and prevent you from seeing your family, just how absurd and ridiculous it all they are. And yet how actually serious and not ridiculous any of it is, because it's so, the stakes are so high.
Yeah. So yeah, tell us what's next. What do you, you know, the book came out a year ago. Are you under pressure to get something out, or are you just kind of enjoying the ride of promoting, you know, You Exist Too Much?
You would think that I would just enjoy things for a change, but no, there's instead all this pressure and to do the next thing. And which is fine. I mean, I think I like pressure, and I think I bring it on to myself, and maybe every writer does, but like, yeah, I'm writing an essay collection. It also explores themes around like diaspora and immigrant and first generation, and also a lot of other stuff. But I find that I get really shy or anxious when I talk about whatever I'm writing. So I'll just leave it at that. And then I'm writing another novel as well that's set between the Middle East and Europe instead of the States. And it's very, very different than this one. Wow. And then, yeah, I guess also this, as you say, like just sort of talking about the book and promotion and whatever else there is that comes with writing a book. It's such a strange experience. Suddenly you're outward facing versus the inward facing, which is what you've been for the last however many years you were writing it. So
did you ever envision that the book tour for your first book would be almost completely virtual?
Not for a second. If of all the things I anticipated, that was not one of them, you know. But the minute I found out that was going to be the case, I just like let go and stopped caring, because I had zero control. It wasn't some mistake I had made. So it was like, well, what can I do? Here we all are trapped together. So
inshallah, your next book, you'll be signing autographs in person in a bookstore, you know, sitting behind that table, greeting your fans.
I really hope so.
It seems like a long way off, but I think we'll get there.
I hope so.
Great. Then, you know, thank you, Zaina, for joining us on the Scene Gene podcast today. It was a pleasure exploring your book and talking with you about what it's like growing up Palestinian American in the U.S. and how that informed your writing. So thank you, and thank everybody out there for listening.
Thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
Today's episode of the Seeing Jean podcast was hosted by Matthew Jaber Stifler. It was produced by Asma Baban, Muhammad Jafar, and Maryam Razet. It was edited by Muhammad Jafar with support from Eric Kiska. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maisara Abdelhak. Seeing Jean is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Seeing Jean is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Ford Community Development Fund. Thank you for listening.